Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Ultimate form of revenge for me is success.
Dr. Dre!
I'm going to keep being successful and make you look like shit.
Dr. Dre is a huge icon in music and culture. He first got famous in the late 1980s with the rap group N.W.A., at the time considered to be the most dangerous group ever.
The lyrics are shocking and offensive to some and very, very, very explicit. But these are...
And his influence has snowballed ever since. His debut solo album, The Chronic, single-handedly reshaped hip-hop with his unique way of mixing brutal and raw lyrics with fresh, funky beats, setting a new standard for producers everywhere.
I just want to inspire and be inspired.
As a rapper, producer, entrepreneur, and self-proclaimed professional winner,
I always call myself a fucking professional winner.
Dre has done it all. He's also a talent scout extraordinaire, discovering stars like Snoop Dogg, Eminem, and 50 Cent. Plus, he co-founded Beats by Dre, a wildly successful brand, eventually bought by Apple for a staggering $3 billion. This is the incredible journey of Dr. Dre. Andre Rommel Young, the legend we all bow down to as Dr. Dre, was born on February 18, 1965, in the iconic landscape of Los Angeles.
You were just 15, is that right?
I actually had just turned 16.
So you were 15 when you got pregnant, 16 when you had him.
Exactly, February 18th. And so he was sort of like a birthday present, a little doll. And I just, you know, I read books, child psychology books, stuff, because I wanted to be a good mother and prove all these people wrong that in the neighborhood, you hear the little whispers, oh, she, look at her, she's not going to be nothing, and her child's not going to be nothing either.
Growing up, Dre's crib was a symphony of influences. His parents loved music, and their vinyl shrine featuring the likes of Diana Ross and James Brown didn't just fill the room, they saturated his very essence. It wasn't long before Dre found himself hypnotized by vinyl records and turntables. But life at home wasn't happy.
I spent a lot of my time in the bedroom, away from everybody. A lot of people didn't even know he had a wife.
Just to give you some context, here Verna is talking about Dre's father and his friends.
Because I'm, you know, they were in there, you know, smoking and, you know, drinking and doing, you know, what have you. And I just didn't want my child to be around that. And I would always keep my eye out the window and looking at strange cars and stuff parked across the street or down the street, thinking, you know, what happens if the police come and take everybody to jail and they take my child away?
After his parents split, Dre and his mom bounced between homes, ending up in the tough Wilmington Arms housing project in Compton.
That is a house that Dr. Dre grew up in.
Family life, however, didn't get any easier, and tragedy struck them multiple times.
I have five children. I have my oldest, Andre, and my youngest, Shamika, who is 30. Now, I lost three boys. One died at 2 months old. We don't know what. They just labeled it something. He was healthy. And I woke up one morning and he was dead. That took a toll on me. Oh, my God. I could hear a baby crying in the distance. I started drinking. And I had one that died. He was only a day old. I delivered him prematurely. And the one that hurt, I think, the most was my son that got killed in 89. He was 21 years old and got killed by a gang member.
Yeah, your son, Tyree.
Yeah, but it was devastating. I thought I was a walking zombie half the time, and that's another thing.
His mom, Verna, worked multiple jobs and was the family's backbone, teaching Dre a brutal work ethic. Needless to say, school didn't interest him at all. His passion was music.
Everybody's not fortunate enough to be a doctor or a lawyer, you know? Everybody doesn't complete 4 years of college, you know?
One Christmas, he got a music mixer, and that changed everything. Dre turned his home into a music lab, spending hours creating his unique sound. Dre's big break came at Eve After Dark, a gritty LA nightclub. He started as Dr. J, inspired by his basketball hero, Julius Erving. This club was a hot spot for new talent and is where he met DJ Yella, who would later join him in the supergroup NWA, as we're going to see in just a second. Soon, Dre evolved into Dr. Dre, merging his old alias with his first name, declaring himself the master of mixology. This wasn't just a new name, it was a statement of his ambition. In 1984, Dre joined the world-class Wrecking Crew. Dressed in flashy outfits, they dominated the early 80s West Coast electro hop scene. However, the glitz and glam of the Wrecking Crew began to feel stifling. The polished electro rap vibe started to feel like a gilded cage as Dre found himself drawn to a different style of rap.
I mean, Ice-T had a big influence on a lot of people out here because he actually started it to me. Ice-T and Schoolie D, actually, because, you know, they were saying things that we can relate to, you know.
Enter 1986. Dre met Ice Cube, who was crafting what he called street reality rap.
I was living with my mom, and, you know, at that time, her idea of what my future was going to be didn't agree with my idea. So I decided to leave and go spend some time at my aunt's house, which happened to live two houses down from Cube, and that's how we met.
I met Dre when I was about 14 years old. He was already part of the Wrecking Crew. He was like the most famous person we all knew. And so he heard me rap, and he just liked me. And so, you know, he started to come over more and more, and, you know, I started helping him write rhymes for the Wrecking Crew. And
Cube's undeniable talent and dirty lyrics immediately struck a chord with Dre.
And, you know, we used to make mixtapes and do different things in the garage and what have you. And what we would do was take popular songs at the time, and Cube would change the lyrics and make them dirty.
The two started performing in clubs with Cube dropping bars and Dre spinning tracks right in the heart of Compton during the peak of the crack epidemic.
But like, man, like, there were certain things that was going on, like the crack epidemic.
Yeah,
what was
we got
going
all
on
that
with,
in there.
With the gangsterism,
the
you know?
Police brutality.
Is yes,
really,
sir.
You know, it's really a period. The period is between 86 and 96. So we couldn't stop.
In 1987, the game changed. Local drug dealer Eric Wright, better known as Eazy-E, decided to clean his money by founding Ruthless Records with Jerry Heller. Eazy-E saw great potential in Dre and Cube, roping them in to make music for his newborn music label.
So Eazy found Dre, and Eazy wanted to be a manager, to have rappers and have a label and all that. Dre convinced him, like, you got a voice, man. Fuck this manager shit. You got a voice. You got a style. You got flavor, man. Do it. And so he ended up.
It wasn't long before they brought in MC Ren and DJ Yella, officially forming the legendary rap group known as NWA. But Dre wasn't just part of the group. He was architecting a full-blown music revolution.
But if you look at every NWA song, there's only one person that did something on every single NWA song, and that was Andre Rommel Young.
Yeah.
Dr. Dre. He wrote the music for every song that ever came out on Ruthless.
Choice of a new generation.
After dropping their explosive debut album Straight Outta Compton in 1988, NWA swiftly earned the notorious title of the world's most dangerous group.
The craziest part about this revolution that we started is this album, Straight Outta Compton, was only done in 6 weeks, 5 days a week studio time, you know what I mean? At 3 hours a day. You know, so it was crazy how this happened, and it just let me know how powerful I could be. I'm like, damn, if people are buying this, wait till I really get a chance to get in the studio on some real equipment with some real time.
This major, you know, because every time we went in the studio, we was basically just trying to make records that were gonna rock our neighborhood or just rock L.A. We wanted to become L.A. stars. We wasn't even thinking any further than Los Angeles, to tell you the truth. Maybe Oakland, you know what I'm saying?
The FBI zeroed in on their incendiary lyrics, particularly the track Fuck the Police, and attempts to muzzle the song only threw gasoline on the fire.
The lyrics are shocking and offensive to some and very, very, very explicit. But these are the lyrics.
The album's razor-sharp political commentary morphed into a national free speech battle, with the track becoming a lightning rod for debate about America's sacred right to speak one's mind.
NWA not only changed music, but we changed pop culture all over the world because we made it all right for artists to be themselves. You know, you didn't have to be squeaky clean to be just as big or bigger than the squeaky clean artist.
Straight Outta Compton, NWA.
We're gonna be ourselves no matter what. On record, off record, we're gonna be ourselves. And I think it opened the floodgates for artists who wanted to be a little raw.
As NWA's tour gained momentum and media frenzy, the blistering critique in Fuck the Police stood out amidst an album otherwise laced with nihilism, misogyny, and an unapologetic embrace of Public Enemy's confrontational sonic arsenal.
Niggers with Attitude, known as NWA, has taunted law enforcement with its lyrics urging violence against police. But it is the group's sexually explicit lyrics that attracted attention from the Attorney General's office.
This is frankly offensive to me, and I think to any parent that would hear and would know what these lyrics are all about, they would find that it is nothing but filth.
Predictably, the cops didn't take kindly to NWA's defiance.
So they came on stage to try to arrest us and show everybody, you can't say fuck the police in Detroit. You know, they's gonna make an example out of us. But they didn't arrest us on the stage, so they little plan they had didn't work. So, you know, we got a letter from the FBI telling us about our record, Fuck the Police, and how they didn't appreciate the way the lyrics was, you know, presented to everybody. And we got a lot of flack over that, but...
But as with many great things, money proved to be their Achilles heel. By December 1989, Ice Cube had had enough. After penning many of the album's hard-hitting lyrics and featuring prominently on the tracks, he felt cheated out of his fair share by Eazy-E and Jerry Heller.
Well, you know, it's really a joke in this day and age for people to think that you can steal money in a record in the record business.
Yeah.
It's not possible. We would get the numbers at the end of the quarter.
Yes.
Eazy and I. His business manager would go over them. We would send them to our lawyers. Our lawyers would go over them. The accountants would then draw up all the paperwork. Then we would send it, whether it was Cube or whoever, his business manager and his lawyer.
Yeah.
It was all done by a computer. You know, to think about that, a picture of Eazy and I sitting there late at night with green eyeshadows on cooking the books. It's just a joke. It's not possible.
Yeah.
So anyone that even would believe something like that, it's ridiculous.
His fallout with Heller over royalties became the final straw. Cube split from NWA, launching a solo career where he didn't hesitate to throw lyrical darts at his former crew.
Got all suckers 100 miles and running.
Like to give a shout out to the DOC.
He was very, very jealous of Eazy. And of course, he was jealous of the relationship between Easy and I.
Cube's subsequent success in music and film, with hits like America's Most Wanted in 1990 and Boys in the Hood in 1991, validated his decision to go solo.
A lot of rumors going around about the group breaking up and everything. That's not happening. We're still a part of NWA, NWA is still together.
Meanwhile, in 1991, NWA dropped their second album amidst chaos. Police raids on distribution warehouses and arrests of sellers only heightened the album's allure.
In Florida, a store owner was arrested and convicted for selling.
That same year, Dre's temper got the best of him. At a Hollywood party, he assaulted TV host Dee Barnes after her show Pump It Up aired a segment on Ice Cube, which he didn't appreciate.
I don't like the manager because he wasn't paying me my money.
That's the bottom line.
Bottom line, that's it. No more NWA.
Dre was fined $2,500, given 2 years probation, sentenced to 240 hours of community service, and forced to appear in an anti-violence PSA.
Yo, this is Dr. Dre.
Yeah, all these things you're hearing, and it just, like, waking up in the morning, one morning I woke up and I had my radio on, and I wake up to Dr. Dre is being sought for stabbing a 17-year-old kid. And I was like, oh my God. And first thing I thought, I don't know what, was to call Andre, and he's at home in his bed. And I said, well, Andre, I was like going, they're talking about you were involved in this thing, you know. And he says, wasn't me. he said, Mom, you can't believe everything the media says. And I said, okay, I'm gonna keep that thought, but how do I know when I should really be worrying? So it was a little scary.
NWA's story ended predictably in controversy and violence. Dre, echoing Cube's complaints about unpaid royalties, sought Shug Knight's help to break free from Ruthless Records.
Nobody ever sued, so obviously they were just using it as an excuse in Compton or wherever to say, you know, we got rid of the white guy, you know, because, you know, he was helping Easy steal or whatever. But, you know, it's nobody ever sued me and nobody ever sued him. So obviously it was all bullshit.
Knight, known for his intimidating tactics, successfully got Dre out of his contract.
I read and I seen that the guy was only getting 1 point, 2 points, and it was cross-collateralizing everything.
Right.
Even though he was a producer, along with Yellow, if J.J. Fagg go in the hole,
right,
he got to pay for it.
Right.
So it's no way, if he produced and worked for 20 years, he wouldn't have never seen any money. He was always been recouped.
So you went in there with the business savvy.
Right.
Shug Knight, to me, marked the end of fun in hip-hop. Before that, it was fun. We all had fun, man.
Yeah.
After Shug Knight got involved, there was no more fun. There were guys sitting in our office with Uzis 24 hours a day. You know, so he changed the entire complexion of what was happening at Ruthless.
With Dre as his star artist, Knight founded Death Row Records, revolutionizing the rap scene with a new level of musical and lyrical intensity. Dre's departure from Ruthless marked the start of a new, equally turbulent and transformative era in rap. With Dre as his right-hand man, Shug Knight started scooping up raw, untamed talent from the gritty streets of California, birthing Death Row Records. Knight wasn't just stopping at record deals. He got the label hooked up with the 1992 film Deep Cover. The single from the movie? Yeah, that's the one where Dre declared his independence, with Snoop Dogg as his hungry, streetwise apprentice.
Dr. Dre was the perfect father figure, role model, mentor, and producer for me at the time because I was young, I was raw, but I needed direction and I needed some sculpting.
And he was able to shape me and mold me and teach me the right way of how to do it. And he had the right team around me. And I've always respected the fact that he was willing to teach me when I was not who I am today.
It was around this chaotic creative frenzy that work on The Chronic kicked off, featuring Snoop Dogg and the rest of Death Row's roster.
The Chronic. In Bud we trust. Yeah, man, The Chronic is like, you know, it's the bomb thing on the street right now, you know? And I figure, you know, my album is the bomb, so I had to call it that.
Fueled by powerhouse singles like Nothing But a G-Thang, Let Me Ride, and Dre Day, with Snoop Dogg dropping verses like a lyrical sniper, The Chronic was a cultural grenade ready to blow the lid off the rap scene. The G-Funk revolution steamrolled through the early 90s, reshaping the very DNA of hip-hop.
My thing is the music, you know. That's my main thing. Doing the music, the beats, yeah. Funky tracks.
By 1993, the Recording Industry Association of America stamped the album with a triple platinum seal of approval, and Dre snagged a Grammy for Best Rap Solo Performance with Let Me Ride. Billboard wasn't sleeping on Dre's domination either. They crowned him the 8th best-selling artist of the year, placed The Chronic as the 6th best-selling album, and Nothing But a G-Thang as the 11th best-selling single.
The original version of Nothing But a G-Thang was made to a Boss Gags song. I can't remember the name of the song, but Snoop was actually in jail, and I really wanted this demo done. So he called in, and I taped the receiver of the phone to the mic.
Hilarious.
And you can hear jail sounds in the back and everything. He's one, two, that whole thing. So that was the original version. I just happened to be at my mom's house going through records, and then I found this Leon Haywood, I Want to Do Something Freaky to You, and thought that would make a better foundation track. So took that back, recorded the track. Snoop got out, and we just recorded this song at my house. It was a bedroom that I converted into a studio at my house. That's where this the first half of The Chronic was
made. And what was Snoop like at that time when you guys were doing Nothing But a G-Thang?
We were just having fun, man.
Read it off.
We recorded G-Thang first, then I got locked up, then I got out, and then we did Deep Cover. And Deep Cover came out first, and then we re-recorded G-Thang once my shit had got healed. Because my voice was, like, fucked up, but once my shit had got healed, my shit was crisp as a motherfucker. I heard that shit in my earphone. I'm like, this nigga Dr. Dre is the shit, cuz. My shit sounded clean, like, one, two, three, into the four. That shit was, like, crystal clear.
It wasn't just music, and it was a movement, with Dre and his crew leading the charge.
I just want to inspire and be inspired. You know,
Dr. Dre wasn't just busy crafting his own legendary tracks. He was the wizard behind the curtain for Snoop Dogg's debut, Doggy Style. This wasn't just any debut. It smashed records, crashing into the Billboard 200 album charts at number one like a runaway freight train. By 94, Dre was sprinkling his magic on soundtracks for Above the Rim and Murder Was the Case, turning film scores into street anthems.
You can talk about certain things in a song and in music and get flack for it and not get the same flack if the same thing was projected in a movie.
Exactly.
Or a book. It's a really weird thing, and I've had this conversation with people, like, why does music get such a bad rap when it comes to, let's just say it's gunplay in a song?
Mm-hmm.
It would get a bad rap. But you have movies where they're killing like 1,000 people in it and nothing is said. That's because music has the ability to touch your soul, and it's a different type of touch. It's a different type of experience when you're listening to music.
Then came the legendary truce with Ice Cube, resulting in the hard-hitting track Natural Born Killahs in 95. As if that wasn't enough, Dre dropped Keep Their Heads Ringin' for the movie Friday, a track that rocketed to number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100 and snatched the top spot on the Hot Rap Singles charts. He was a fucking hit-making machine, leaving a trail of platinum records and chart-topping singles in his wake. In 95, Death Row Records pulled a power move by signing Tupac, quickly positioning him as their crown jewel. The dynamic duo of Tupac and Dr. Dre dropped the seismic single, California Love, rocketing both artists to the top of the Billboard Hot 100 for the first time. It seemed like a golden era for the label, but the backstage drama was a different story.
So by the time it got to Death Row, the only difference was these are guys that were either going, either on their way to the penitentiary or just coming home from the penitentiary.
I mean, a lot of those guys that worked there were scared just to come to work because somebody might just come in and whoop your ass.
It was hell, you know, going in there and dealing with these folks.
I always tease you about being unhappy. They came here one night, and I'm trying to do the monologue, right? Him and all his partners sitting looking at me like this. I was throwing my best stuff in it. Are you enjoying life? You enjoying your career?
Yeah, it's cool, you know. I'm loving it.
Because it was still guys that was hanging around with that bully mentality that want to poke you and push your buttons because they know they can do it. They know you're not going to do nothing kind of stuff.
Shoe Knight's menacing shadow loomed large over Death Row, his legal run-ins and brutal reputation often stealing the spotlight from the label's musical triumphs.
That's when Suge Knight was the monster, the boogeyman. That's when he was the boogeyman.
The most infamous chapter was the East Coast-West Coast beef with Death Row squaring off against Bad Boy Records, fronted by Sean Diddy Combs and the Notorious B.I.G. More than a rivalry, it was a full-blown media circus hyped to a fever pitch, ultimately leading to the tragic drive-by shootings of both Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls. The loss left a gaping wound in the hip-hop world, spawning endless conspiracy theories that still echo through the culture today. Amidst the chaos, Dre saw the writing on the wall. Frustrated by Knight's escalating violence and the toxic environment at the label, he made the wise move to bail in 1996.
You know, Dre was willing to leave Death Row with nothing. He walked out with no masters, no money, nothing.
I've walked away from millions of dollars, Kevin. You know, it's if it's not right, I'm not with it. I'm not about to leave with a wet ass. You know what I mean? I'm not doing that.
Right before the storm claimed the lives of Tupac and Biggie, Dre made one of the smartest moves in hip-hop history and stepped out to form his own label, proving his genius wasn't just in the studio, but in navigating the dangerous streets of the music industry. In 1996, Dr. Dre left Death Row Records to start Aftermath Entertainment, teaming up with Interscope Records for distribution, promotion, and financial support. This let Dre focus on his music while having a major label's backing. Aftermath aimed for quality over quantity, targeting high-profile releases.
All of a sudden, I'm on my own again, and I have to go find, you know, new artists and new musicians to work with. Fortunately for me, I had done it once before. I know what the feeling of starting over feels like.
However, the label's first release, Dr. Dre Presents the Aftermath, dropped in November 1996, and it was a bloated, boring mess, often unlistenable.
I just felt like the music I was doing at that time, it wasn't completely up to par. It was just something that we were working on and experimenting with it.
The whole thing bombed, trashed by critics and fans, threatening Dre's future career.
Just, it didn't smash.
Dre flopped again in 1997 with The Album, the debut project of The Firm, a supergroup featuring Nas, AZ, Foxy Brown, and Nature. Despite hitting number one, it was criticized for being too pop-centric and lacking chemistry. The group was soon dropped from Aftermath and later disbanded. If Dre's magic touch wasn't completely gone, it was definitely missing.
I just felt like maybe I needed to bump into the right artist or the right musician or whatever, and I didn't have that at the time.
Rumors swirled that Aftermath was in financial trouble. On top of that, the label got slapped with a trademark infringement lawsuit by the underground thrash metal band Aftermath. The turning point came in 1998, when Dre's friend Jimmy Iovine, co-founder of Interscope Records, played him a demo from a white rapper in Detroit named Eminem.
Jimmy Iovine introduced me to Eminem, and that's when everything took off.
His intense multisyllabic rhymes were refreshing. Within minutes, Dre knew they had found something special.
Back in those days, I didn't have an artist to work with. I would go to Jimmy's house and have listening sessions. And I remember him picking up this cassette tape, and I was like, what the fuck, and who the fuck is that?
Despite industry skepticism about a white rapper from Detroit, both Dre and Iovine believed Eminem's talent was too potent to ignore, a gamble that obviously paid off.
Everybody say, that can't work. It won't sell over there. It won't sell over there. All people have is what they saw before. I just felt that everybody in the world was going to dig this shit the way I did.
Dre and M's first studio session was electric. The chemistry was undeniable. And within minutes, they started crafting one of Eminem's biggest hits, My Name Is.
He was hungry, I was hungry, and it was just like, you know, that spontaneous combustion, you know, we just clicked, and that just brought everything and everybody together that was happening at that time.
The public response was overwhelming. The track soared to the top of the charts, turning Eminem from an obscure rapper into a national sensation overnight. This success validated Dre's decision to sign Eminem, silencing critics and solidifying his reputation as a visionary producer. More importantly, it also marked the start of a new era in hip-hop, with Dre and Eminem at the forefront, their legacies forever intertwined.
And we found out that what we were doing, it really works. And that's all we needed. It's like, okay, the Slim Shady LP, they like that. How do we know it works? Wait till they hear this. And then we went in and started working on my second solo album, 2001.
Dr. Dre's second solo album, 2001, dropped in November 1999, marking a flashy return to his gangsta rap roots. Initially titled The Chronic 2000 to suggest a sequel to his debut album, it was renamed 2001 after Death Row Records released a compilation with that same title.
I think at that time, I wanted to call the album The Chronic 2000, right? And my previous partners from Death Row, I heard that they were doing an album called The Chronic 2000. Okay. And it was actually Jimmy Iovine's idea to call the album 2001. You know, so yeah. I didn't really give a fuck. I thought the music was great. I thought that everything that we were doing was fantastic. And I just said, okay, fuck it. What's in the title? Let's just call it 2001. It's almost like a shot at them. They called their shit 2000. Right. I said, okay, yeah, that'd be great. 2001. So that's the story behind it.
The album featured numerous collaborators, including Snoop Dogg, Exhibit, Nate Dogg, Eminem, and Mary J. Blige, among others. 2001 was a massive success, charting at number 2 on the Billboard 200 and achieving 6 times platinum certification. The album included hit singles like Still Dre and Forgot About Dre.
That was Eminem's idea. He wrote the song for me and Snoop originally. He laid the reference vocals for Snoop, and I liked the way it sounded, so we just kept it that way, and I laid my vocals, and that was it.
Following the success of 2001, Dr. Dre focused on producing for other artists. He co-produced 6 tracks on Eminem's The Marshall Mathers LP, including the Grammy-winning lead single, The Real Slim Shady. The album itself won a Grammy and became the fastest-selling rap album ever, with 1.76 million units sold in its first week. In 2001, Dre produced Family Affair for Mary J. Blige's album No More Drama and Let Me Blow Your Mind, a duet by rapper Eve and Gwen Stefani.
Dre is like a complete inspiration for me. Like, I've been listening to his music before it was even a serious idea for me to get next to him.
In 2002, Dre signed 50 Cent to Aftermath in a joint venture with Interscope and Eminem's Shady Records. Dre served as executive producer for 50's debut album, Get Rich or Die Tryin', which would be released in February 2003.
So I did the Get Rich or Die Tryin'. It was supposed to be me producing half of the album and Eminem producing the other half. I was in the studio with 50 for just 7 days for my entire half of the album.
Yeah.
He came in there and went crazy. writing. All right, put up another one. Writing, put up another one. And we got the entire thing done in 7 days, at least my half.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
The album was a commercial success, with Dre co-producing half of it. After producing more albums and tracks for Eminem, 50 Cent, and other artists, Dre was ranked 54th on Rolling Stone's 2005 list of The Immortals, the greatest artists of all time. Dre's third album, originally called Detox, was planned as his final album, first announced to be released in 2007 and later pushed to 2010. Detox remains unreleased at the time of this video, but Dre's story doesn't end there.
He's always had the attitude and the spirit of, I don't care about what I made, it's all about what I'm about to make.
As the music industry faced the triumph of piracy and illegal downloads, Dre found a new game, headphones. Teaming up with Jimmy Iovine and Monster Cable, Beats by Dre launched in 2008. The brand quickly grew, adding portable wireless speakers and online music streaming. So much so that in 2014, Apple bought Beats for $3.2 billion, its biggest purchase ever. The Beats brand was so strong that Apple kept the name and design untouched.
I always call myself a fucking professional winner.
In 2015, Dre co-produced Straight Outta Compton with Ice Cube, showing NWA's rise and fall. The film, highlighting the brutal street life and the triumph of the band, made over $200 million worldwide. Later, Dre tried again to portray his rough upbringing with the Apple series Vital Signs. However, the project got shelved due to excessive drug use, violence, and explicit sex scenes.
Ultimate form of revenge for me is success. I'm gonna keep being successful and make you look like shit.
Around that time, Dre also surprised the hip-hop world by scraping his Detox album and releasing instead Compton alongside the NWA movie premiere. The album's label as a companion to the movie, however, doesn't do justice to its originality. But the real surprise is that Dre, a 50-year-old near billionaire, comes across as energized and relevant on this album. He has always thrived on collaborating with other rappers and producers, using their talent to shape his own legacy. On Compton, he takes this approach to the next level. The album feels personal yet communal, often letting other vocalists take center stage while he supports from the sidelines. Dre has shaped hip-hop for decades. He brought ambitious orchestration to the genre in the 90s and transformed it by absorbing everything around it. His past classics showed us new possibilities, a rare magic. Compton may not have the same awe-inspiring impact, but it's still excellent, perhaps even more complex and surprising than anyone expected.
My music isn't for everybody. You know, I just love recording. It's for my friends and family, and really just for me. And some of it's to hold, some of it's to be sold.
To note, Dre donated all profits from the album to Compton High School to build a new performing arts center for the students.
There was nothing there that I really wanted to learn. I mean, of course I wanted to learn math and reading and all that, but I'm an artist, and there, you know, in Compton, in my particular high school, there was nothing there available, you know? This thing that we're building has everything that I needed.
Additionally, Dre and Iovine donated $70 million to the University of Southern California to support a four-year program blending liberal arts, design, business, and technology.
One of the kids that comes out of our academy has the potential to go on and do something to change the world. That's the thing that's the most interesting to me.
In 2022, Dre teamed up with Snoop Dogg, Mary J. Blige, 50 Cent, Eminem, and Kendrick Lamar for the Super Bowl halftime show. The performance snagged three Emmys, including Outstanding Variety Special, the first time a Super Bowl halftime show ever won in that category.
mean, everybody really felt the magnitude of what this thing was and what we were going to be able to accomplish. And it was a fantastic experience.
In 2023, the Recording Academy and Black Music Collective launched the Dr. Dre Global Impact Award to honor his groundbreaking work in music.
Yeah, I'm extremely moved by this award. I want to say thank you to the Recording Academy and the Black Music Collective for this honor.
And in March 2024, he got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Did you ever imagine you'd have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame?
No, I didn't. That was not in my mental Rolodex at all.
Who in hip-hop could ever overshadow Dr. Dre? His three solo albums, The Chronic, 2001, and Compton barely scratched the surface of his massive influence on the genre.
I'm pushing 40 years in my career right now, and there's just a few artists that I've worked with that were established. Mm-hmm. Those being Tupac, Mary J. Blige, and Busta Rhymes. Those are the only artists that I've worked with in my entire career that were already established. I like working with new and up-and-coming talent. Everybody that I've worked with is just new, fresh, and up-and-coming. And that's what I like to do.
One of his greatest contributions to the genre is his knack for discovering and nurturing young talent. Snoop Dogg, Eminem, 50 Cent, The Game, and Kendrick Lamar are just a few artists Dre has personally mentored, each achieving immense success in shaping hip-hop's sound.
You launched so many careers, worked with so many people, N.W.A., of course, Eazy-E, Snoop Dogg, 50 Cent, Eminem, Tupac, Kendrick Lamar, Anderson .Paak, Mary J. Blige, Gwen Stefani and Eve, T.I., Busta Rhymes, Alicia Keys, Missy Elliott, Exhibit, Warren G, G-Unit, Big Pun, Nate Dogg, Jay-Z, The Game, MC Scat Cat. Oh, wait a minute, that might be...
Just recently, I discovered a new word. It's Fargin, F-A-R-G-I-N, right? I discovered this word, and the definition of it is finding joy in the success of others, right? And that completely defines my personality.
Dr. Dre's enduring legacy is a testament to his multifaceted impact on music and culture. His influence will undoubtedly continue to shape the industry for generations to come, as both an innovator in hip-hop and a visionary entrepreneur.
I'm like excited about the discovery of who I'm going to become, because I'm an entirely different person today than I was just 10 years ago. So in the next 10 years, I'm excited about who I'm going to be.